Hi, everyone. It's Deb. Welcome to the Starting for God BBA workshop. I'm so excited. We're in step three. Isn't it amazing? We were just in step one, I feel like. Now all of a sudden we're in step three. Let's hear who else is on the call today. So again, I'm Deb, and I'm from San Diego, compulsive overeater, restrictor, Al-Anon, chaos creator, drug addict. Lots of stuff. Who else do we have on the line today?
This is Cammie. I'm from Visalia. I'm a drug addict, an alcoholic, bulimic, anorexic, over-exerciser, diet pills, restrictor, compulsive overeater. Thanks.
Nice. Thank you for being here.
I'm Lauren S., a recovered compulsive overeater and body obsessor from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Awesome, Lauren.
Katie G., food addict and alcoholic from Boston.
Hey, Katie.
Suzanne from San Mateo.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
Stephanie from Livermore.
Hello, Stephanie.
Jane in Jerusalem, a recovering compulsive overeater, and very big Al-Anon, CODA, ACA person.
Love it. Glad you're here.
Hi, Jen, compulsive overeater in Burbank, and Al-Anon, and part-time chaos creator and clutterer.
I love the part-time. Welcome.
Hi, it's Lynn, compulsive eater, drug addict from Sherman Oaks.
Hi, Lynn. All right, I think there's still about three or four people that are on the line, but maybe you can't buzz through at this moment. Okay, so before we get into our prayer and meditation, I want to definitely talk about the homework, but before I even talk about the homework, I want to talk about something that's been coming up. I've been talking to a few of you, and especially those folks who started the workshop after we really started it, which was all the way back in September. And there was kind of a window where some new people were joining and they were able to kind of catch up and be a part of the group. But anyone who's been joining, I would say, over the last couple of weeks is like not needing necessarily to catch up to where we are, because what is so valuable about this workshop and the way that we lay it out is being able to have sufficient amount of time in step one and really being able to spend the 6 or 7 weeks that it takes to go through each assignment and to sit with another person, to read your answers to that person, to have the experience to hear their answers, and for both of you to really experience, you know, God cracking your heart open through that process. And so two things that I want to talk about as it relates to that. The one is not rushing through in order to catch up, because really it's just cheating you of the full experience of what this program has to offer. And for the first 103 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 52, 53 pages are all step one. So it lets you know that, like, the bulk of what you want to focus on is really the step one experience. And then everything else, the rest, 2 through 12, are crammed into the rest of the 50 or so pages. So does someone want to just, here, let me just mute you guys and make sure that everybody's. The other piece of it, too, is in finding a step partner who you can do this work with. So I know I've had lots of individual conversations with various people, as this comes up, but I just want to make this statement to all of you, is how vital it is to really do this work with another person. And a lot of us are in situations where we're like, I don't know someone, or I don't have someone, and this is an opportunity for us to reach out and to ideally reach out to somebody who's even in your community, of maybe somebody who is also suffering with food addiction or body image issues or whatever, you know, whatever, bulimia or anorexia. So maybe finding someone who's outside of the BBA format, but who's open to trying this, and that you don't need to find a sponsor, i.e. someone who is going to give you all of the air quotes here answers and be your, you know, sponsor and take you through the work. You can actually find just another buddy, and the two of you can do this work together, because really it's about creating and building and accessing a relationship with God. And so you're not reliant upon each other, and you're actually going to gain a lot from being in that experience together. And so you can just find anybody who's also committed to exploring this work, and the two of you can do the work together. And we do have a growing fellowship within this workshop of people who are available. They might already have a step partner, and they might already be in step three, and maybe you're in step one, but there's lots of people who would be really happy to be a buddy and a partner, and it's only going to illuminate their experience, and so both of you will be gaining so much from it. So I really am not a huge fan. You know, it tells us in step five that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient, and I have come to believe that to be true. Like, it doesn't work when I'm just answering the questions and using my great mind, you know, what I think is my great mind, to make my own self-assessments and then to continue moving through the process. It really, I find that I miss a huge, huge aspect of what this process has to offer me. And the way that we do it in the BBA, really, really identifying, like, the transcribing as being absolutely vital to having an experience. I know I stressed that a lot in the first number of calls, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but to sit down, you with the book, and give yourself the time to do the transcribing is such an important part, and it really is what the BBA is. It really is what distinguishes the BBA, I think, from other processes, helping us really turn those statements into questions and having, you know, a personal experience with the work. And then that next level of sitting with another person after you've answered your Idiot's Guide questions and sharing your answers. And like I've mentioned on previous calls and with a couple of you in one-on-one conversations, is that today I just work with a newcomer. Like, I'm so clear that I'm going to see what I need to see as God reveals me to me and God to me, that I'm always just open. And then when I sit with a newcomer, I always learn something new about myself, and their perspective is so fresh. And so I gain a lot from working with newcomers. And so whether you're working with a newcomer, whether you're working with a buddy, whether you're working with a sponsor, I highly, highly recommend you taking that time, carving out a consistent time each week, setting aside an hour and a half to 2 hours, and you sit down with that person. You start by doing exactly what we do. You do the set-aside prayer. You do 5 minutes of meditation, and then you go into actually reading the assignment out of the chapter, and then reading each other your Idiot's Guide questions and having that conversation. It's an incredible way to fellowship. It's a meeting between meetings. Cannot encourage that enough. And then, of course, having the advantage of having these recordings, then that becomes like the third layer, really. Just like, it's like the icing on the top of the cake to be able to have just this lecture and this group discussion, which just adds another layer of insight and helps us to even get a deeper experience. And so we really have a lot of opportunity to get the full flavor and the full-bodied experience of what this entire program has to offer if we do each one of those steps. And if we're just showing up to the meetings, we're just showing up to this workshop and auditing, if you just are here to audit, no problem. That's fine. Just like own it for what it is. Say, I'm just auditing this time around. I'm not ready to actually do the steps, or I'm not ready. I'm only doing a half measure, and that's not gonna cut it. And so I'm just going to audit this time, but I know that this recording is here, and any time that I want to start, I can find a partner, and we can start and work together, and we can just listen to these recordings each week to, you know, as we're doing the work together. Is there anything else that I want to say about that? Just email me afterwards if you need a partner. And you've done this a couple times before, but it seems to be an appropriate time to do it again. Email me if you need a partner. And if you, and also, please, 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 if you are someone who is willing to be a step buddy or a step partner to somebody else, you don't need to have completed the work. You don't need to be perfect. you don't need to have all the answers. It's just, are you open to doing service, and are you open to creating that sacred space with another person in this program so that the two of you can both get even more freedom? So that's all I'll say about that stuff. Okay, moving into the homework, step four. After today, we're on step four. Very exciting. So what you're going to do on the BDA Works website, that's the new website that we're working with, BDA Works, you have access to everything that you need for your four steps. So if you haven't already, go ahead and print out the fourth step packet. I think it's actually called, Big Book Awakening four-step worksheet, and it's a packet that is filled with resentment inventory examples and worksheets for the fear inventory and for the sex inventory. You're not going to do anything with it right now. I just want you to print it out and just have it with you. I also want you to print out, let's go for no more than 15 copies. No, 15 resentment inventory pages. So you're just going to print those out. I know it says here in your sponsorship guide, print out 30 to 50. When I'm working with someone one-on-one, I might be open to them doing more. But in a workshop setting, I have found that it is most effective to really stay to under 20, if not under 15, and sometimes even under 10 resentment inventories. Because otherwise, especially if you're new to this work, it's very easy to get lost and overwhelmed and to get behind and then just to not do it and get that paralysis by analysis. And so my recommendation is to boil it down to less inventories where you're going to go deep, you're going to see a lot. Because frankly, for me, I mean, I could just ask the very first time I did the step work, the very first time I did the BDA step work, and I did it with Leilani, who you heard, she spoke on Bill's story. I mean, she's got epic recovery. And she said, just focus on, like, your family of origin. Like, just focus on, like, your primary family members. And it was like, I did, like, five or six resentment inventories. And I got to see everything I needed to see, just focusing on like those primary relationships in my life, because everything else was like a theme that delineated from those primary relationships. So whether you feel guided to just focus on your primary relationships with you know, family members and people that are really intimately close in your life, or you just, you know, stick to maybe like 10 resentment inventories or less than 15, I promise you that you will see what you need to see in those primary things, and that the more that we go, the more it just becomes more of the same. So make those photocopies of your resentment inventories. Make those photocopies of your fear grid. You'll get all of this from the website, and of your sex inventory. Maybe 10 copies of the Fear Grid, 10 copies of the sex inventory. You're going to do your transcribing. So we're starting with the bottom of page 63 to the bottom of page 66, ending at the word poison. All of this is written in your sponsorship guide, by the way. I'm not going over anything that you don't already have. And then the big thing here is this week is to sit in meditation and to ask God, like, please help me see the truth about my resentments. And you're going to just list the people, the institutions, or the principles that you are resentful at. And just trust whatever you're guided to. Trust whatever comes up. I do recommend that if it's your first time doing the Big Book Awakening, that you really stick to people and institutions. The principles get a little bit more tricky. And so if you've done the VBA work before, we can talk more about the principles. But I'm going to really have people focus on the people and institutions. You're going to see a lot. So any questions about the homework, feel free to email me. That is that. Very, very exciting. Okay, so let's get into a little
Deb,
P and S. Yes, hello.
Deb, hi, it's Lauren. I have a question for you about the homework. Are you
yes.
saying that we are now, that our next assignment is assignment 13?
Yes.
Okay.
You got it.
Okay. And
any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
And then just stick to the resentment. If it's the first one, just stick to the resentment inventory.
Yeah, so
family.
I'm sorry. Sorry, let me go ahead and finish what you were saying.
The resentment inventory, just focusing on people in our family.
Okay, so thank you for asking that, because I hear what you're asking. So when you sit in meditation and you ask, please help me see the truth about my resentments, whatever names come to you, write those down onto your list. Write them down. Write the names, write the institutions. Maybe you've got a resentment at the church or at marriage as an institution or at, you know, the boss or the this or the that, and you're just going to make your list. What I was sharing, because do you see how it says, make 30 to 50 copies of your resentment inventory?
Yes.
Yeah, so I have found that, like, that number seems completely over the top in my experience. My experience is that most of the people that I work with usually have less than 20 resentment inventories that they focus on, and they see a lot, and they're able to get a lot from that. And I was recommending that because we're in a workshop and we're in a committed time frame, and all of you are going to have a lot of time to do this stuff. We're not speeding through the four steps at all. But I'm just asking, to be brief,
never mind. It's okay. I can talk to you later about it.
Okay, so I was just saying that something that I had done before was I had just focused on my family members, and I still saw a lot. So it was more just giving you an example of how only focusing on, like, five resentment inventories, still gave me a full experience. So I'm not saying that you have to do that. I'm saying that that's something that I did, and I still got a lot of value from. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. And we can talk more about your specific situation. So thank you for asking that, because I'm sure other people had that as a question. Okay. Any other questions about that? Okay. So without further ado, let's move into our set-aside prayer. And we are looking at our step 3 set-aside prayer, the failure of my life, run on self-will. So we're going to read that together, and then we'll go into a few minutes of meditation. So, God, please enable me to to set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth about the failure of my life run on self-will and my decision to turn my will and my life over to God.
Okay, so
this is not, there's not a lot of pages here, so I'm probably going to be reading the whole thing, and I know that we hear this read all the time, and it's really easy to kind of tune out, and so I'm inviting all of us today to really set aside any past experiences of reading this and or of hearing it read in the rooms and meetings and really open up for a new experience. And I'm going to read it transcribed in the way that it was originally, the original transcript. So I'm going to read it with those little edits that you have transcribed into your book. And of course, we're going to talk about it as we go. And yeah, just see how it lands with you today. So
Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Is that me? Am I not completely giving myself over to the simple program? Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And we talked about this all the way back in the doctor's opinion of I cannot tell the truth from the false. You know, my overeating and restricting life seems the only normal one. I'm in this delusion. It tells me all the way back in the doctor's opinion. And even before we got into the doctor's opinion, when we were talking about the approach or the attitude to bring to the work, as we talked about the set-aside prayer, we also talked about the acronym of HOW, of praying to God, help me to be honest, help me to be open-minded, help me to be willing. And so we're hearing here in this first paragraph that it's going to be my inability to be honest with myself that's going to actually hold me back from the recovery that I desire. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They have seemed to have been born that way. They are on their own, incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. It's really funny because I remember, I know a couple of you identified as being Al-Anons. So the first time I did this work through with looking at my Al-Anon issues and my chaos-creating issues, which I can't even, the next workshop I do will be on chaos creators because I've had, and on Al-Anon, I've had such incredible recovery there, but and in relationships. But I remember going through this work and thinking, because I was like trying to fix the relationship, right? As I was going through, and you know, he was an addict, and like, and I was gonna do this work because I was gonna figure it out, and I was gonna figure him out, and fix the relationship. And I remember reading this and being like, this is talking about him. You know, he's incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. And I was so focused on him. And now I read it and I just say, where is this me today? So it just shows some of the way that this program has changed me and just in my questions. So their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. So our the stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided that you want what we have I decided that I want that? And I'm willing to go to any length to get it, that I'm ready to take these proven steps. So this is a place in the work where when we go through the BBA, we encourage, you know, I encourage people who I'm going through with, like I've signed and dated, or I've put like my initials and I've put a date right after the word steps. So if you feel called to do that too, it's because at any moment going forward, if I balk, I can always come back to this and say, well, and I'm reading this right now, well, because I buy a new book every year, so this is my book from this year. So on September 8th, 2014, I committed to go to any length. And being in my ninth step and 10, 11, and 12, my willingness to do 9, 10, and 11, and 12 on a daily basis comes down to this commitment. So at some of these, you may balk. You may think that you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And I mean, this book is filled with little opportunities for me to meditate, you know, and like, what does it mean to me today to let go absolutely? What does that actually mean? I was recently going to do this energy healing work with these coaches who I can't even put into words what they do is so much more than energy healing or body work or coaching. It's like I can't even put it into words. But anyway, they had asked me to get really clear on what the
things that I wanted in life were, like what I wanted to manifest. And as I was driving to their place to go have this session, I took all of this stuff to God, and I thought, okay, yes, I have these desires of my heart and these desires of what I'd like to manifest in my life. And in that moment, I'm like, but here, God, you take it all. And if it's your desire that these things come to fruition, fantastic. And if it's your desire that none of this happens and something else happens, that's fantastic too. Like, I let go absolutely of all of this. I let go of my attachment and needing either thing to happen. Remember, you are dealing with food and restricting, cunning and baffling and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. And I always, anytime it's talking to me about middle of the road solutions or half measures, I'm always wanting to ask myself, it's a time where I can pause in the work and I can say, where am I in my circle and my triangle? And how am I half-assing my program? How am I half-assing the steps? How am I half-assing my daily prayer and meditation? Working with others? Service work? How am I half-assing this? Am I doing any half measures? Because it's going to avail me nothing. It's not going to avail me half. It's going to avail me nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. I love that. So now that we're after the first two steps, now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which we are suggested as your program of recovery. So have I admitted that I'm powerless over food and restricting and that my life has become unmanageable? Am I willing to come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity? Right? And then it continues here. Made a decision to turn our will, right, my thoughts, our lives, my actions, over to the care of God as we understood him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely willing to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially restrictors and food addicts, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set are guides to progress, and we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And I always ask myself when I read that, am I still trying to be perfect in my program? And am I still shaming myself when I'm not perfect? Like, do I read that? I'm like, yeah, progress versus perfection, but I still need to be perfect. You might be focusing on progress, but I need to be perfect. Our description of the food addict or the restrictor, the chapter to the agnostics, right? So we've got step one and step two, and your personal experience, not just in your disease, but also in your abstinence, have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. That abstinent or not, right, in relapse or not, I am a food addict or a restrictor, and I cannot manage my own life. That's step one. And we talked about this last time when we were looking at We Agnostics. I'm not here You know, that I have this delusion that I'm going to do this work and then I'm going to be able to manage my life, but I'm going to gain manageability and be able to manage my life as a result of doing this work. And this A is really clear. Like, I'm not here to learn how to manage my life. I'm here to develop the access to a power that I can hand my life over to that will run it for me. So it's very, very different. So this is A, that probably no human power could relieve my food and body issues. And this is the one that sometimes we have that honest doubt crop up, that God can and will if he is sought. So, and then I love the transcription. If you're not convinced of these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. If you are convinced, you are at step three. So being convinced of A, B, and C. We were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? So we're going to get the answer to that in two pages, and on the last paragraph on page 62. So the first requirement, so there's five requirements, and there's a speaker, he's not actually a BBA speaker, his name's David Marquez, great guy, he's in the AA fellowship, and I heard him speak at a BBA meeting once, and he shared these five requirements in step five. So step three. So I'm gonna identify those as we cross them. But the first requirement is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. So one of the questions that I can garner from this is, well, what does a successful life look like? And do I still think that I need stuff out here, right, in the outside of my life, to look a certain way for me to have a successful life? And maybe we want to knee-jerk that, like, no, I know that it's not about that, but then, like, how am I really living? You know, do I really still, am I still attached to, well, when my body looks this way, or when I have a relationship, or that when the relationship looks this way, or when my finances look this way, or when the career looks this way, and, like, am I still... or when I get certain, you know, feedback or validation from the world out here, then it means I'm successful. Am I still relying on that stuff to a certain extent, or to what extent am I relying on that stuff? Or today, do I feel that a successful life means that I'm just not living in the bedevilment? Because that really, when I really, really connect in with who God would have me be, and I really ask myself that question, that's what comes true. Is that a successful life means that I have healthy relationships and, you know, a life-affirming relationships and activities in my life. I feel useful. I am of real help. I'm happy. You know, these kinds of things. And it's a question. Is that today what's defining my success? What is defining my success? So it's a great meditation. On that basis, we are almost always in, before I move on, the other side of that too, and I know this was a question in your Idiot's Guide, am I convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success? So when I consider that question, I look at, well, yeah, my life run on self-will is hardly a success because, and we just answered that in step two, as we looked at the bedevilments, like when, if God is everything or if God is nothing. So if God is nothing, that's about how my life run on self-will looks. Because if there's no other power and I'm the only power, then I'm only running off of my own power. And that's when I need too much out of relationships, and I'm a prey to misery and depression, and I'm full of fear. I'm pretty much motivated by and act from my fears, and I operate on selfish motives and the theme of self-preservation. How can I take care of mine because I feel like there isn't enough to go around, and how can I take care of me? You know, this this less than or not enough, too much stuff going on. And I've got to look at this failure of my life run on self-will is not just talking about when I'm in relapse, but it's also talking about when I'm in abstinence or food abstinence. Is this stuff still happening to me? How are my romances? How are my finances? How are my friendships? How's my career? How's my program? How am I showing up in the world? You know, so these are all the questions that I can ask myself. It's great because what I do is, and I share this with people who I work with, I like to take a moment and close my eyes and consider all the different roles that I play in the world, all the different hats that I wear, all the different personas that I have. And, you know, I've got my daughter, and I mean, not my daughter, I'm a daughter, and I'm a sister, and a cousin, and a niece, and a friend, and a sponsor, and a sponsee, and a member of the fellowship, and a teacher, and a student, and a mentor, and a business owner, and a wellness coach, and a healer. I mean, I make this whole long list: artist, girlfriend, citizen, a lover, a spiritual seeker, a speaker, a writer, a marketeer, a boss, a partner. I even wrote down how I show up, on Facebook and social media, because that's a certain persona, you know? And so what I do is I close my eyes, and I picture all of these parts of myself sitting around this big, massive board table. We're in, a boardroom. And they're all sitting, and they're all, everyone's dressed differently, because I don't know about you, but, I dress differently when I'm playing one role versus another role, and I'm, sitting differently, and I've got a different expression on my face. And so what I do is when I get to my third step, and this is what I, I invite people who I work with to do, is to create this scene in their minds in a meditation, and then to bring each one of those personas, each one of those roles into my frame and ask myself, is God running this part of my life all the time? And what I start to see is that there's always new ways that I can hand my will and my life over to God. It helps me to broaden my consideration of what my life is and what that means, and at the same time get really specific. Because I don't know about you, but when we start talking about will and life and all this stuff, it's I can let myself get lost in the generality of the word will and of the word life. And I can kind of hide in that, and my disease can hide in that. And the image that I just got in my mind was brushing your teeth, giving yourself 5 seconds to kind of just brushing your teeth with your finger. I don't know if you've ever lost your toothbrush. And you're at a hotel or you're wherever and you don't have a toothbrush, and so you take your toothpaste and you kind of use your finger to kind of put the toothpaste all around your mouth. Okay, so the difference between that and then having a really, really high-end electric toothbrush that you take 5 minutes and you're going around each tooth and you're looking at every single where all the plaque is hiding and all the little the nooks and crannies of every single tooth in your gums and stuff. I don't know why I just got that image, but it's the difference between me just looking at my life, which can just be this very, very general thing where I don't actually get much depth out of it, and then going really, really deep into the specific ways that I and the roles that I show up in allows me to have deeper access and to see some little nooks and crannies that I'm not bringing the sunlight of the spirit. So on that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody. Well, of course I'm always in collision with something or somebody, because I need too much from you. I need you to show up a certain way for me to be okay. And I have motives. You know, it tells me here, even though my motives are good. Yeah, but I have motives. So, you know, we talked about in the last chapter from the bedevilments, like, can I be of real help? And especially if I have this Al-Anon temperament, you know, I think I can be of real help all the time, especially if my motives are good. Advice giving because my motives are good, because I see something that I think that you need to be doing, and my motives are good. But what it's letting you know here is that even though I think I know how to help you, I have motives. And as long as I have motives, there's a selfish agenda behind it. And so that's what it's telling me here, is that when I'm working for God, which after this chapter we're going to be working for God, when I'm working for God, I don't have motive. Like my motive, my will is aligned with God, or at least that's what this process is helping me to do, is to align my will with God's, and then I'm acting from that place. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. And so I hope that each one of you did the assignment of reading this every day for a week and putting your name in it. I'm going to read it with my name, and I hope that you did it with yours. Debbie is like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in her own way. Let's read it this way. Debbie is like an actor who is trying to run the whole relationship, forever trying to arrange the details and the scenery and her boyfriend in her own way. Or Debbie is like an actor who is trying to run the whole situation, forever trying to arrange the plans and how her friends are. You get the idea. You can really plug anything in here. If Debbie's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as Debbie wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including Debbie, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, Debbie may sometimes be quite virtuous. Debbie may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, Debbie may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, Debbie's more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. Debbie begins to think life doesn't treat her right. How many times has that happened to you? The show doesn't come off that well. Why doesn't the show come off that well? Because I think that I know how it's supposed to go. And then it doesn't go the way I think it's supposed to. And then all of a sudden, I'm sore. I'm burned. You did something to me. Debbie decides to exert herself even more. Debbie becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Can you see yourself in this? I completely see myself in this. Totally. Still, the play does not suit Debbie. Admitting Debbie may be somewhat at fault, she is sure that other people are more to blame. And how true is that? Yes, I can kind of see, but that other person is way more to blame. Debbie becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying, just like that restless, irritable, and discontent, right? What is Debbie's basic trouble? Is Debbie not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? That's a big dose of honesty there. I mean, that's a hard pill to swallow. Am I not really a self-seeker, even when I'm trying to be kind? Because why is that? Well, so let's say let's say we're sitting down to a meal that you just prepared, and I don't like it. I don't think it's very good. And, but I, like, don't want to say anything. I don't want to hurt your feelings. You're like, no. You're like, I'm really, really trying to get this, you know, I'm really trying to I want to cook this meal for somebody else, and I want your feedback. And, like, you don't want to hurt their feelings. And so you're like, no, it's good. No, it's good. And you think that you're doing that to protect them. But really, I know it's kind of a crappy example, but I'm sure there's a lot of really, really good examples that each one of us could have picked from. But what's really going on is that it's actually self-preservation. Like, I don't want to have to deal with the awkwardness of me saying that and your reaction to that, and like, I don't want to have to, because I feel like I've got to manage your experience, and so I don't want to deal with any of that. And so it's just easier for me to not speak my truth, to not speak up. And how many times do we do that? How many times do we not speak up or speak our truth because it's just easier? We don't want to create waves. I mean, a lot of us have just spent a lot of the holiday stuff with family. So here we are. You know, we've just done Thanksgivings and we've done Christmases and we've done a lot of that. And there might probably has been a lot of that kind of behavior going on where it's actually coming from a place of self-preservation, even though I'm trying to be kind. And it's telling me that that's actually self-seeking behavior. Is Debbie not a victim of the delusion that she can force satisfaction, she can wrest satisfaction? The word wrestle comes from the word rest. Satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only she manages it well. Absolutely. Oh, and what just occurred to me to share is when we are in, and I know I've mentioned this before, but it just occurred to me to share it right now. When we're in that place of not speaking up and speaking our truth because we don't want to create waves or we don't know how to handle our emotions or we don't know how to handle other people's emotions, what invariably happens with those of us who have food issues is we will either stuff it down or we will throw it up or we will do something around our throat chakra because we're having to, like, jam the circuit. Like, our mind is saying, don't say anything. Our heart is saying, I have feelings that I want to share. And it's all twisted up. And so our throat gets, twisted, like bottlenecked. And that's when we usually will do something addictive, either by stuffing those feelings down or, like, stuffing those words down or by binging and purging or by restricting. But it's really, really common. So I just felt called to share that. So is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things that Debbie wants? And do not Debbie's actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is Debbie not, even in her best moments, a producer of confusion rather than of harmony? And I just love that. I mean, they're so good how they write this. So I'm sitting here trying to be the director and trying to run everything. And so I'm trying to be I'm the actor who's also trying to be the director who ends up being a producer of confusion. I mean, it's really comical when you think about it. And it's letting me know that when I'm living and existing on my own power, of which I already got really clear, I don't have any power. I got clear in the last chapter that lack of power is my dilemma. But when I'm trying to live on that lack of power, I'm only producing confusion. And it's only on God's power that I'm going to be able to live in harmony with myself and with others. And we're going to really, really get to deepen into this whole visual that they're giving us. They're giving us this analogy or this metaphor of what it's, you know, of being like an actor. And when we get into our fourth step, we get into resentment inventory, I'm going to actually invite you to say, okay, so here you are. Let's take you, director. Let's put you in your director's chair. Let's give you the beret, you know, sit in your director's chair. It says director on the back. And now you're going to watch the scene. And you're going to watch yourself because you're also an actor. So you're a director and you're an actor. You're going to watch your scene with yourself and the other players, and you're going to see how the scene plays out and how the plot goes. And we're going to have a chance to actually do that and write about that in our inventory process. It'll be really cool. Debbie is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. She's like the retired businesswoman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, the politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged her, and the compulsive overeater restrictor who has lost all and is locked up. So what are all these, like, they just gave all these, like, different types of people. And what I see in common with all these people is that they're all living on the sidelines of life, and they're all judging everyone else and thinking that, you know, with a self-righteous attitude, thinking that they know what's best. And so I always ask myself, like, where am I in that? And then, you know, it uses this word self-centered, and it gives us this transcription at the bottom that self-centered doesn't mean that I think too much or too little of myself. What it means is that I think too often of myself. So we don't get away with saying, you know, oh, well, I just have such low self-esteem, I couldn't be egocentric the way they're talking about it, because that has nothing to do with it. In fact, being so consumed with my low self-esteem, depression is one of the most egocentric things as well. So it's how often I think of myself. And of course I'm thinking of myself all the time, because if I'm coming from an agnostic temperament, if I have agnosticism in me, and it means that there is no other power, right, then I have to constantly be thinking about my problems, because there's nothing else for me to turn to. So I'm constantly thinking about myself and my problems, because I'm the only thing that can fix it. So then on page 62, whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity? And there it is right there. I mean, again, if I'm coming at this with an agnostic temperament, then I can only be thinking of myself all the time. I need to be fixing my problems. So this paragraph right here that we're about to read is so, so important. Selfishness, self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. So I don't know if you remember back in Bill's story, but he talked about removing root and branch, that there is this analogy, and that he's on entirely new footing. But there's this whole analogy of, like, this tree imagery, and we're going to be seeing more of that. I'm going to be talking more about that in the fourth step. But they're talking about this root. And now a lot of us read that in the rooms, but what we don't read is the second sentence. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. So it's driven by 100 forms of fear. And when we look at the fourth step, this is actually, when we get into the fourth column of our fourth step, this is actually the order that we're going to look at things in, or the order that things happen in. I have this fear, which drives my delusions, which drives my selfish thinking, which drives my selfish actions. And so it's actually highlighting that right now. And I have to get really, really clear that I have a disease of selfishness, that my disease at the end of the day isn't a disease of food or with this or with that, but it's actually a disease of selfishness. And that selfish isn't acting in my own self-interest. That's not what selfish means. Selfish means the disregard for the welfare of others. Selfish is the disregard for the welfare of others. And so can I see that that's how I've been living my life? Even when my motives are good, even when I'm trying to be kind. So we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but invariably we find at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So what I want to do at this point is I want to take a pause in reading, and what I'd actually like to do is open up the call and have a little bit of discussion, even if it's just for 10 minutes or so, where we talk about a few of these points, a few of the answers from your idiot's guide. So what I'm going to pose a few different questions, and And then you can star six yourself to share your answers or to share your experience. So going from the Idiot's Guide on page 22, so in the How It Works questions, number two, are you convinced that your life run on your will can hardly be a success, and why? And are you convinced that your romances, finances, friendship, marriage, career run on your self-will can hardly be a success, and why?
Lauren S.
Hi, sorry, who is that?
Lauren S.
Hi, Lauren.
Oh, thank you. hi, everybody. Lauren S., as in Sam, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a recovered compulsive overeater and body obsessor. So, oh my gosh, on Lauren's will, you know, I, as we relate, I'm a tornado. And the thing is often I don't realize the impact my actions have. You know, I'm in this delusion, which is quite frightening, you know. and just looking at, you know, how every single aspect of my life is affected outside of the food. You know, the food is just a symptom. I can see that, yes, like on Lauren's will, Lauren's self-will, my life isn't successful. Finances, I, you know, I have a disease that demands treatment, you know, and if I'm not compulsively eating, I need to treat this disease in some way. And often I shop, you know, relationships. I use people for my own selfish reasons, whether they like it or not. Friendships. I use friendships too. I come and go. I have friends convenient, you know, when it's convenient for me. I hang out with people when it's not convenient for me. I kind of drop the friendship. And every area is almost used as like another addiction. Like if I'm not treating my food addiction if I'm not treating my spiritual malady with God, I'm treating it with, like, you know, abusing friendships, abusing relationships, abusing money, abusing my body, abusing my health, you know, abusing my work. I'll, like, overwork, or I'll oversleep or undersleep. I don't, on my own power, I don't know how to live healthy, sane, and happy. I can't live by like a manifesto or a meditation on my own power. So thank you for letting me share, and I'll pass.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's, I think a lot of people, including myself, relate to that, so thank you. So you can, if you feel called to still answer that question, you can. I'm going to add another question into the mix. Have you tried to live by self-propulsion? Are you like an actor who wants to run the whole show? Are you forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in your own way? In what ways?
This is Katie G. from Boston.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Deb. Hi, everybody. This is Katie G. from Boston. I am totally trying to get everybody to do what I want, and I believe the lie that if people would just do what I want, I would be happy. And especially at work, I engage in a lot of self-seeking behavior, like looking at the schedule that my boss is supposed to manage, and I manage it for her. I go in there and I put patients on my schedule, because I believe the lie that if I just have enough patients, then I'll get enough hours, and then I'll get enough money, and then I'll be okay. And I take things personally when people are sarcastic with me, and I'm like, if people would just be nice to me, I would feel happy all the time, and I wouldn't have to be so angry or like people are not setting my patients up appropriately. And I just see how, you know, like at first when people are, you know, not doing what I want, I'll be really nice. I'll be like, oh, Anne, it's so nice to see you. Will you come help me? And then when Anne isn't doing what I want, I'm like, Anne, I need your help. A patient's life is on the line. You know, like, and I just see that I just try and manage everything. And I think I just wanted to share, too, and then I'll close this. I felt really devastated by this work. Like, this step three, like, confirmed for me that my life, and I'm not eating today, thank you, God, but my life today is so devastatingly small because I am making all these decisions based on self and based on, like, my direction, and I feel physically incapable of doing anything different. Like, I know that I need to do things differently, and I talk about it on my step 11 and in step 10 sometimes talking to women, and I, like, physically feel incapable of doing it differently. So I think that point of devastation is pretty good because it's going to motivate me to do the work, but I just wanted to share it with a really, like, rude, crystal clear awakening that what I'm doing is just simply not working, and that's on my path.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that share. Great shares. I'm going to add another question into the mix. You can speak on the other two. Do you believe selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of your troubles, and in what ways?
Hi, this is Stephanie from Livermore.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I wanted to just talk about the self-propulsion, trying to live by self-propulsion. And I had to look that word up because I wasn't quite sure the context of it. And what I found was it's the force of being driven. And the example it gave was a vehicle provided with its own sense of power rather than requiring an external means of propulsion. And with regards to food, the way I answer this question is I have tried my self-will and using my self-will and being consumed with self-propulsion in terms of trying to control my weight and my behavior. I've tried every possible way. And this whole idea of, you know, using my own power to get through life versus relying on an external power has very deep roots for me. When I was a little kid, I remember the early messages I got from my mom, which is never, ever, ever put yourself in a position where you have to receive help from anybody ever, ever. Mm-hmm. Don't depend on anybody. I took that to a whole other level, and, you know, what happens with that is that oftentimes God is an afterthought, or I go to God when, you know, I've made a mess of things already, or it is just so ingrained to rely on my own strength, and I'm really done with it. It's exhausting. I had the best Christmas that I've had in years, and what I noticed, though, was after it was all done, you know, December 26th, I'm like, get this tree out of here. Like, I want everything down. I want my life back. And when I took that to meditation, it really seemed like I must have been, like, really relying on my own strength and like, a tornado sort of propelling myself into, you know, trying to make sure. Talk about motive. You know, thinking that I'm being helpful, but really I'm just trying to get the feelings off of me, whatever they might be. So this has been really eye-opening for me. It has been a lovely, lovely experience working on Step 3, especially through the holidays, calling and talking with my step partner and reading, doing that daily reading could not have come at a better time for me. So that's it. Thanks.
Stephanie, thank you for that share. And it is, it's exhausting. I think that that's a great word to summarize how living like this is. Not only is it not successful, but it's actually just simply exhausting, which is why on page 88, you know, it says that we won't tire so easily because we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. All this stuff comes full circle. The last question, maybe we'll just get one more comment from one more person. And you can answer any of the previous questions. I'm just going to also add, are you driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity in what ways?
This is Cammie from Visalia.
Hey, Cammie.
Hi. So, thanks, Deb, for everything. You know, every single thing that I look at in my life, I can trace it back to the underlining fear. And it really isn't a mistake that it was written that we are driven. These things drive my thoughts, my actions, my behavior, my feelings, my emotions, the way I show up in relationships. If I stop and go deep within, I can see how I'm driven by fear. And my struggle lately has been that I really don't know how to connect to the power. And I feel like I was on step one for like 9 months, and I got so clear on my powerlessness, and I know how much power I don't have and my inability to connect to the power in a way that I can feel, see, and use and direct, that I just kind of sit back and wait for the power to show up. And so I don't know if I'm making any sense, but I don't feel like I have any conscious contact with a higher power, so I don't even try. Like, I just sit there, and I'm just kind of like, okay, God, I don't really know what to say. I don't know what to say. I just sit here in step one. I sit here in step two. I sit in step three, and I'm just waiting. And I keep telling myself, well, it's going to come. With the power is going to come with the work and the inventory, and just keep doing what you're doing. But, like, when we sit in meditation, I feel totally disconnected. And when I read my 84 to 86, I feel totally powerless to pull any of that off. I try to pull it off, but I just feel very powerless. And I guess that's, I feel powerless in my disease with the way I'm acting out in my food also. And so I just also feel like I wanted to share how scared I am that this is really taking off now into step four, and that it's going to get real. Like, I'm going to have to sit down and start doing some work and start feeling some feelings and start putting some thoughts behind it. And I'm really scared because I've been to this place many times. I think I'm afraid of living without food, living without bulimia, living without restricting and really being rid of that. I don't know what that's going to look like. I'm afraid of what's going to come up when I start doing all this work. And I've been waiting for this place in my program, but and now that I'm finally here, I'm like, oh, crap, already? And so driven by 100 forms of fear, I think, relates to that. And my feelings of being unable to really connect and use this power in step three, but just talking to my step partner and telling her that where we're at is that we just need to be willing to believe. And I've tried to control and manage my recovery so hard in so many ways before that I'm not even trying to control that. I'm not trying to control my spiritual walk. That's kind of why I feel kind of empty and neutral. because I've tried to connect so hard so many times with God in the way that I feel like I need to, and it hasn't happened, that I just have given up. And I guess maybe that's a good place to be, but so that's it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jan, compulsive eater in Burbank.
Jan, sorry, I didn't realize I was on mute. I just want to really, really quickly just say something to Cammie. Do you mind just hanging for 1 second?
Don't mind at all.
Okay. Cammie, gosh, I as you were sharing, what was so apparent to me was that you were having conscious contact with God while you were sharing. Like, we just read at the beginning of this chapter that those people who do not recover, people who cannot give themselves over this program, they're constitutionally incapable of being honest themselves. And you just got onto the call, and you were just honest and shared exactly where you were at. And that is all that we can ask for, is the willingness and the honesty and the open-mindedness to continue doing it. And so I was getting like a lump in my throat listening to you, because like you holding yourself back from actually, like, you are experiencing conscious contact as you're speaking is just, it's like, yeah, totally. So I feel like we create, and that's another thing that sometimes gets in the way for me, is that I create in my mind's eye what I think conscious contact is supposed to be like and how I think it's supposed to feel in my system. And so I don't even realize, like, when it's actually, like, hitting me over the head like a 2x4. So I just want to say, like, sister, I feel you, and you are exactly where you're supposed to be, and you actually are speaking into, like, you're being the voice for a lot of people who are on this call or who people who are going to listen to this call after it's recorded, who have the exact same fear going on. And so you've been a real help to others. You've actually been totally working the program just in your share. So talk about conscious contact. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Deb. I really appreciate your confirmation in that, and that you can see that, even though sometimes within ourselves we can't. I really appreciate that. So you've passed the lump in your throat on to me. I'll see you next week.
Okay. Okay, Jan. Talk to us.
Okay, thanks. I want to address two things. The selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of my troubles. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. And in the end, I end up stepping on the toes of others, and they retaliate. And then I respond as a good Al-Anon and try to be overly sweet to convince them that what I did originally wasn't self-centered and was for, quote, their good. And I think all of that is deeply ingrained in me. Another thing, my best moments, am I a producer of confusion rather than harmony? I love music. That's one of my first loves. And the word harmony, when notes are in harmony, there's no dissonance. You can have one note off. I can have one little, I think it's my best idea where I'm trying to be the director. And I don't check in with God all the time. And I don't check in with my coworkers or my son or my family at Christmas. And there's dissonance. And then there's also in music something called a grace note, which I think is such a neat term. And, you know, that can just be a slight embellishment. Someone come along and say, really think that's the best way to do it, which happened to me with family at Christmas. And I was actually present and open enough to say, what do you think? And it wasn't sarcastic. I mean, it was, you know, truly a moment where I wasn't trying to be the director. And, man, the 100 forms of fear and self-delusion, self-pity, self-seeking, I'll give a quick drive time for like a one-minute example.
Of course.
Okay. My family, there were going to be 13 of us, but we weren't sure exactly which nephews and nieces were coming down. So we're at my mom and dad's, and I'm asking who would like to help with getting enough chairs to go around the two tables. and no one says anything. And I was pissed inside, but I just decided, you know, I didn't say anything, and I went back to, you know, to setting up the buffet food or whatever it was. And when it was time for people to get their food and have a seat, there weren't chairs put around. And I have to admit, I felt really, man, I was the director. I didn't say anything, but to myself, I was saying, see, I told you, you didn't go get a chair. And I don't want to be that person today. I want to be, like my step sponsor teaches me, I want to be a woman in recovery. And I want to remember to connect into God. I mean, I've got that power strip that's like, it's plugged into the wall, but I don't flip it on. There's that little on switch, and I'm not always connecting. I mean, I know I'm human, but these steps, what we're doing is just incredible. And as an aside, the part about 100 forms of fear, I know I have fear in my financial arena at times. And since we've been working these steps, BBA, my FICO score has increased. So I just wanted to throw that in too. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Jen. You know, when each of you choose to share and to really speak from your heart, I hear that as a prayer. Like, I hear what you just shared as a prayer, Jan, and I know that's received as a prayer. You know, when we say, I just want this, I just want to be able to feel God or whatever it is, like it's I believe that it's heard as a prayer and it's answered. So thank you for sharing that. Any other burning desires to share before we move forward? There won't be time for sharing after. So this is the time if you have a burning desire to share.
This is Suzanne.
Hey, Suzanne.
Hi. And I also wanted to comment on reading the passage to my partner, and I found that I also thought it was kind of miraculous that it was this week that we were doing it, because it, for me at least, it's a very tricky week. And I loved, you know, that reminder of how selfish I am. And the first day that my partner and I did it, after we were done, I had just this warm feeling in my heart, and it was just really neat. I've done it before, and I never ever would have dreamed that I would, do the process. This is like the third time I've done it, and I would have that experience, and because I didn't the other two times that I've gone through the BBA. And the other thing that I found was I did read it to my husband a couple of times, and I really and what came to me too was when we get down the road to step 11, and since it's also connected with step 7, is to look at that with my retiring at night, and seeing how I can really incorporate that more. I'd really like to be reading that passage more. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Suzanne. And I, that is a practice that we do in the BBA in San Diego. Oftentimes people will read pages 60 to 63 and then read pages 84 to 88. And I know someone shared earlier 84 to 86. That's just step 10, but actually 84 to 88, it's really that 86 to 88 that is step 11, and that's really teaching me about that morning, that daily review, that how to close off my day and how to start my each day. And that stuff is so valuable for me, so I really need to focus on not just my step 10, but in my step 11 as well. And so, yeah, thank you. Thank you. And
I will speak a little bit about that because you're absolutely right. Those of you who even referenced the step 11 or step 10 and step 11, there is an absolute link from 3 to 11. Thank you for sharing. Any last, like, 1 or 2 minute burning desires to share? Okay. So who's there?
Yeah, this is Lauren. I guess I didn't unmute myself.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah. We got just 2 minutes. Yeah, please.
When I was going over the answers with my step partner, what I really saw was my belief in God, but my complete hesitance to turn my will over to God and my reliance on self-sufficiency, and that I've never really seen that so clearly, that I do believe in God, but my hesitance to turn my life and my will over to God. And yet there are times when I've done it. Yesterday, I wanted to go to the store and get something to eat, and I knew that it would be really bad if I did that. And I just let myself be open, and I made a U-turn, and I didn't go to the store. And so I've seen when it works, but what I've also seen really clearly these last couple days is my hesitance in turning my life and my will over to a higher power that I do believe in and that I know exists. And I've never really seen that so clearly before, and that kind of came out in the questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that honest doubt and that fear, and, you know, anyone who ever says that, you know, fear and faith don't coexist, I think that that's such a bunch of crap, because my experience, especially as it relates to this program, is being aware that, gosh, I see this cropping up. I see this this honest doubt cropping up. Will this work for me? And still choosing, I'm still willing to move forward. I'm still open-minded, and I'm still hoping that this does actually completely work, even though I have this, like, honest doubt, like, is this going to work? Because I'm scared, because I just can't imagine what that is like. I don't even know what that means, you know, to go to any lengths or to hand my will and my life over. So, yeah, thank you for everybody sharing.
Hey, Deb, it's Lynn. Can I just say something for 1 minute?
Sure. Yeah.
Hi, and thanks for going over all of this. You know, what I really connected to was when you talked about the throat chakra thing. That connection to an experience or two I had with an interaction with someone over the last few days, and not speaking my truth about feelings about plans we were making, and it was all about him, and just, being nice, being self-seeking. I mean, because I wanted to be there, and yet I wasn't speaking my truth. And what that wound up looking like was my food got bigger, and my choices were different than what they normally have been in my 40 plus days of abstinence. And you know, when you were talking about that, I just really see that if I would have turned to God in that situation and you know, had the access, the power to maybe say how I really felt in a you know, respectful way and just honor my truth, that maybe my food would have looked a little different. So I just really appreciate that connection. So thanks.
Thank you for that. I, you know, it was funny. I noticed myself when I started, because
I do a lot of work with people with that stuff. I do coaching, and we look at archetypes, and we look at chakras, and I noticed myself launching into like kind of like a sidebar conversation, and I realized let me just keep it within the realm of, you know, what we're focusing on here. So I thank you. I'm glad that you got some value, and there's a whole lot more that I would love to share about on that topic. So I mentioned that there are these five requirements. So we got the first requirement. The second requirement is that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I need to get that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem, okay? And then move on with the reading here. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the overeater restrictor is an extreme example of a self will run riot. So I know you transcribed this. This is probably the greatest statement of hope and recovery in this book. Why? Because nothing on the outside needs to change in order for my life to be recreated. That it's telling me that these problems arise out of me, and I get to see that in, you know, when we look at, like, the spiritual malady and the bedevilments and the lake and, like, you know, I can't see the clarity. I can't see clear water, but I can see what's reflected around it. And so I know that this stuff arises out of me, and what's reflected in my life is really painting the picture of what's going on inside of me. And I also learned in step two that the solution is inside of me as well, and that I'm blocked from it. And so this is saying that this process is going to allow me to get unblocked, and that if the problem's inside of me and the solution's inside of me, then nothing else in my world needs to change. My family needs to change. My relationships don't need to change. My career doesn't need to change. My finances, my body, nothing else needs to change in order for me to feel free. That is an incredible statement in this program. It's an incredible promise. And second to, like, the 10-step promises, this is, like, my favorite promise in the book. Above everything, we overeaters and restrictors must be rid of the selfishness. We must or it will kill us. This is the third requirement that I get this, that I have to be rid of the selfishness or it's going to kill me. And God makes that possible. And they're often, and I just have a side note here that to be rid of the selfishness, and this is where I was confused for a long time in my program. I'm like, well, I can be recovered in mind and body, but then I'm always recovering in spirit. Like, what is that? What does that mean? You know, because sometimes some people say I'm recovered, some people say I'm recovering, and this book promises recovery. It says you will be recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but then it's like contingent upon the maintenance of your spiritual program, right? And so the way that I can be rid of this selfishness on a daily basis is to treat that selfishness with 10, 11, and 12. And that I personally have to be in an active 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. Otherwise, I'm not treating that selfishness, and my ego rebuilds every single day. There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not, and we already talked about that, right? I have these philosophies of life and these convictions, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. This is the fourth requirement. Can I see that? I can't reduce my self-centeredness. So here, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root. I must be rid of it or it's going to kill me. And why is it going to kill me? And that was very easy to read that and kind of like gloss over. But it's going to kill me because as long as selfishness and self-centeredness is what is driving my behaviors in my life, there's no room for God, right? That ego edging God out, there's no room for God. And if there's no room for God and I'm continuing to live in that bitter morass of self-pity, I'm continuing to feel restless, irritable, and discontent, it's only a matter of time before I seek the elusive sensation, that ease and comfort of that first bite or that first skipped meal.
So, and it'll take me back out, and then I'll be spiritually dead, if not actually physically dead. So we have the fourth requirement. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. Okay, so this is now bringing us full circle from page 60, where it's going to tell us the how and the why. This is how it works, and this is why it works. So how is that I have to stop playing God. That's the fifth requirement. You got to stop playing God. Why? Because playing God doesn't work. End of story, right? And then next we decide. So here is the third step decision. So I know a lot of people think that the third step decision is the third step prayer, but that's just like the confirmation of this decision that I'm making. So here we have the decision. Next we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. So what does a director do? So a director assigns my role, right? Tells me how to be. So I've got to ask myself, how successful have I been running my life on my own direction? How successful have I been being the director? Because I think I've been a producer of confusion. He is the principal. So, and I'm his agent. So an agent represents who the principal would have them be. You know, sometimes people think of this as like, I'm a travel agent or a real estate agent or an insurance agent, and I'm representing what the organization would have me be, right? I'm representing what the principal would have me be. I think of it as like Charlie's Angels. I don't know why I always get that reference in my mind. But how successful, I've got to ask myself, have I been in my life being who I think I should be, who I think I am, and telling others how I think they should be? How successful has that been? How's that working out for me? He is the father, and we are his children. And sometimes I'll just say he is the mother or the parent, or like the father and the mother, because I actually, for me personally, I find a different energy when I consider God as my father versus God as my mother. I get like a different way of feeling that, like providing and protecting. Sometimes that maternal energy feels very nurturing to me, and sometimes that's the energy that I'm needing from God. So I think of that as God being the father, but the main idea is that a father figure or a parental figure is a provider. And so on your own power, how successful have you been at providing what you need? Just some good questions. And then, of course, you have your transcribed questions at the bottom that are you ready to make the decision that hereafter God's going to direct your life? And these are all, each one of these questions are wonderful to take into meditation. I love that. And I think Suzanne mentioned earlier about bringing this stuff into her daily 11-step. And I love it. Any day that I start out my day considering God, please, as my director, like, who you have me be, show me the role that you'll assign me. As my employer, you know, what is the work that you have for me? And I go through each one of these roles. It always just opens up this incredibly magical day. I encourage you to try that. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept will be the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass through to freedom. So, again, we have this arch, this, you know, we got this foundation, right, that we got on page 17 with the equal parts of the fellowship and the solution. And then we got the cornerstone in step 2, our willingness to believe. And now we're adding the keystone. And the keystone is that central stone that goes up at the top of the arch. And it's at the summit, right? And it holds everything together. It actually, in a structure, it locks the whole thing together. It says that it's the central principle or part on which everything else depends. So that's what we're putting into place here. And oftentimes we can visualize that we're walking through this archway, and it's out out here, this beautiful archway. But consider, you know, just as we learned in We Agnostics, that the fundamental idea of God is deep down within. And so perhaps consider that this archway that we're going to pass through is actually within our own heart. We're going to pass into our own heart, and we're going to go deeper within. So what I'd like to do at this time is I'd like for us to pause, and we're going to have a meditation, about an 8-minute meditation. And I invite you to go to a place that feels spiritual to you. So maybe it's a beach, or it's a garden, or a temple. But I want you to find that sanctuary, that sacredness within your own heart. And in that sacred place, connect to that essence of God or creator or spirit, whatever you call that entity or that energy. And you're going to have a talk in your own way, using your own words, about what it means to you to hand your will and your life over. So we're going to do that right now. So just get yourself in a comfortable position. There's no way to do this wrong or right, just how you're guided. And trust everything that happens. And I'll see you on the other side.
Okay. As you come back into this group, I want to read the promises, the third step promises. And then we'll say our third step prayer together. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans, and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. I just love that. Just love that. And so if you feel called right now to sit or to kneel or to light a candle, but we're going to say our third step together, and just because of the noise, I'm not going to have us all unmute ourselves. But know that we are all in this moment holding hands in community across the world, and that you're taking this third step with your brothers and your sisters. And we don't say an amen at the end of this prayer, because the idea is that after we say the third step prayer, we're actually held in the grace of that prayer all the way through to the end of the seventh step. And then we say our seventh step prayer, we put an amen at the end of the seventh step. And so whatever our conception is of God as we understand him right now, that is enough to carry us through into our fourth step. And we continue to develop the reliance upon God as we turn to God in each one of those moments. And then we complete this entire prayer process with the seventh step. So we will not say amen at the end of our third step. God, I offer myself to be, to build with me, and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. So what begins as a concept in step three, when we get to step 11 on page 87 down at the bottom, it tells us, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. That is my relationship with my father figure, parent figure. We constantly remind ourselves that we are no longer running the show. That's my relationship with this director. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. That is my relationship with the principal. So it becomes a way of life in step 11.
and we come full circle in this program. So I want to end with a story that Tyla tells every time she takes groups through. The story of Mr. Piggly Wiggly, because she always brings this cute little pig into her workshops. And he tells this story of this pig and this chicken are walking down the street, and they come across this church that says, "Help feed the homeless." And the chicken turns to the pig and is like, "We gotta help." And the pig's like, "Well, how are we gonna help?" And the chicken says, "Well, we can feed them ham and eggs." And the pig says, "Well, hang on a second. For you, that's a really easy decision. You're just gonna lay some eggs. For me, that's like giving my whole life over." And so the question that I ask you as you move forward in this program is, are you going to be a chicken and just lay around hatching eggs? Or are you going to be a pig and give your full life and your will over to this program? So since we finished with our third step prayer, we're not going to finish with the Serenity Prayer. I'm just going to leave you with that and with your experience. If you want to share about your experience, would love to hear about it. Feel free to call me or email me with your experience. And I will see you next week as we move into the fourth step. Bless you.